to another episode of the Sawdust and Fire Podcast. We are your hosts. I am Hunter Johnson.
And I'm Thomas Baldridge.
Thomas, what's going on over in your neck of the woods? You still habitat working? Are you strictly deer hunting, or what's happening?
A little of everything. Got some TSI work project coming up, and got some guys coming to plant some shrub motts and hedgerows. That'll probably happen February sometime, mid-February. And I haven't deer hunted much, but my crew's deer hunted a good bit, and we're behind on the does. I don't really have a good explanation as to why. It's just like my son said the other day, he said they got to come out before I can shoot them, because I was on him about shooting them. But we need to kill some more does. But other than that, it's just time of the year, getting close to Christmas, you know, trying to get kids out of school and enjoy some time with them and family, and then, you know, get prepped for the upcoming year and a couple projects I got there. I'm excited in some ways about 24 for me personally, because in 2024, I'm going to take this place from a very project focused, very building focused to maintenance phase. And I just really am excited that that's going to be a pleasant experience, not having to think about major drastic projects and transformations, you know, of taking this from one thing to the next. Now I'll be able to just fine tune and tweak and maintain.
Boy, that's going to be awesome. That's, I've set a goal for myself for 2024, no new projects, in 2024. We've got a whole lot going on, and you said a couple of things I want to back up and touch on here in just a minute, but, we've got a whole lot going on. We've got two different large scale hack and squirt projects. We've got a pollinator planting project, got some cut and drop we're going to do. We got a bunch of stuff at two different locations. And, of course, you know, we still got the annual maintenance, you know, we got duck food plots that need tended to, some moist soil, and we plant some hot food, and, you know, just the basic everyday maintenance, the mowing and the spraying and, you know, everything that's got to be maintained. But so let's back up just a minute. You said a couple of things I want to touch on a little bit. You talked about shrub motts. Let's talk about what it is, what you're doing, what you're planting, and why.
So the shrub motts, if I remember right, QF folks, biologists, had told me, you know, there's research out there that says it's got to be a certain size. So if it's too small, it's not effective. And I also think if it's too big, it's not effective. So
let's talk about that just a minute before you move on. So too small could become a more or less a wildlife trap for predators.
Sure.
You know, sure. And I watched this dog of mine when, you know, I've got this blood tracking dog, and when I let him out of evenings and he runs in front of the side by side for several miles here, he has learned to run to this brush pile and run to that brush pile and run to this little thicket. He's trying to run him a critter.
Anything. Yeah.
He's hoping he's going to catch him a coon or a fawn deer or something, baby pig or something in there. So when they're small like it, and a predator can run through the middle of it and everything's open around it, if there was turkey poults or quail chicks in there, a fawn deer, and they all disperse out of there. Now they're free game, and they get out in that open, they're going to get caught and killed.
Yes.
So y'all are trying to make these big enough that that's not what they become, that a coyote or a pair of coyotes running through the middle of them, or a coon wandering through the middle, stuff has room to escape that, get out of the way, but still not leave it and be exposed. Is that
right? Right. Pretty much. Now, so it does, some of them can provide food. I was trying to find my list because I wasn't prepped to answer all the different species that we're going to plant, and I got it somewhere.
We know you're doing some plum.
Yeah. Okay. I got my list. I got it. So some of these shrubs are suckering type shrubs. So they're thicket forming. They're going to sucker. And, you know, it is not impossible for a coyote to go through there, or a coon or whatever. But
oh,
it's
he's
also,
going to go through it. Yeah.
It's also like going through a chain link fence.
Yeah.
You know? And so they ain't going to go through it fast. That's for doggone sure. But 1,500 square feet is kind of the number that whatever research, you know, paper they reference says that the Mott needs to be. So you take a field, for example, that doesn't have shrubs. Maybe it's a pollinator planting. That's some of my stuff's going in pollinator plantings. So right now I've got, you know, pollinator plantings that got pollinators and some, you know, native warm season grasses. I even saw some fescue cropping up out there the other day I need to kill. But so you got a good field, but no shrub cover. A lot of our shrubs that are native to our area have been eliminated, man. They were just cleaned up, you know, gone. And that's just what happened for all kinds of reasons. But some of that took an element away. It was another useful tool that in some cases either provided food, thermal cover, escape cover, nesting cover, fawning cover, you know, those types of things. It was just another dimension of that. And so we want to put some of that back. So Chickasaw plum, for me, in my area, is native. And that's one of my biggest ones. And it's a good one. It's real, real cool. Then I've got some rough leaf dogwood, some false indigo, some witch hazel, and some hazelnut. And I did not go with any sumacs because I have winged sumac and aromatic sumac already on the landscape. So that the sumac was on my list, but I've got it naturally occurring in a couple of places. Now, it's not to scale. It's not where it needs to be, but I have some. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do something else that also was here historically. So that's the whole deal. That shrub mott, you know, in about a 1,500 square foot area, you're going to get some, depending on the shrub, you know, you could have summer thermal cover, winter thermal cover, escape cover, fawning cover, food source in some cases, you know, depending on the shrub and if it's producing a berry or a nut or a whatever, or seed or something, you know, depending on the shrub. And you know, escape cover. And then you really, and I can't remember the number offhand, you want these spaced, you know, so far apart so that if, let's say, a covey of quail gets flushed by a coyote, they get up head high and they pitch and go into the shrub mott and he chases them. And then they're weaving around through there and then they flush while he enters the shrub mott, they flush out the other side and pitch to another one. And then he's lost them, you know, kind of deal. So there's some numbers out there, but, and then we're doing a hedgerow planting. Just imagine, you know, It's actually going to be like three species, but Chickasaw being one of them, because that Chickasaw is suckering, and it'll spread on you, and it'll put up shoots, and you know, it's like getting triple the money for, you know, triple the output for the same money, because they're going to propagate, and this all will over time. They're bare root seedlings, so they're little, but they're going to spread. They're going to get taller, bigger, fuller, and then they're going to spread themselves. So that's kind of a cool thing. And the hedgerow is going to provide a, you know, a softer edge, provide the same types of cover and scenarios. And then this is actually in an area where I don't have exactly what I want to kind of separate me from a neighboring property. And it, you know, it's not a bad thing. It's just, I'm just trying to build a little more seclusion there and a softer edge and things like that for, and then all the other benefits. So the head, that's what the hedgerow's for. So in 1 5-acre place, we're going to put two or three shrub motts, and then in another 4 or 5-acre place, we're putting three or four down there. I can't remember without looking at the plan, but anyhow, that's the goal on that.
So let me see if I can paint this picture of what I think you're doing. So you've got a hedgerow that's blocking out, making kind of a screen between you and neighboring property.
Yep.
All right. And let's say, and that you've got that kind of down one side, and you've got a 4 or 5 acre opening that you are going to establish a pollinator mix, native warm season grass pollinator mix across the majority of that block.
That's already done in two areas.
Okay. And now you've got woods around there, so you're going to have a feathered edge kind of around it.
Yep.
And that's going to be an open, wide, grown up feathered edge. And then across the center of this 4 or 5 acre plot, you're going to have these shrub motts
Yep.
strategically placed in areas where you've got basically a thicket of bushes growing
Yep.
up in the middle of this pollinator mix.
Yeah, that's the goal. Or even in the middle of a food plot.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. You can even, in the middle of some of this, strategically place small food plots
That's what's happening.
that you're capable of shooting across, that
That's
you can
it.
kill occasionally. So I just wanted to paint this picture for everybody listening. And people claim that you can't control predators with habitat. Well, that you have to trap them. Now, this is a prime example of how we can control predation for fawns, for turkey poults, for quail chicks. We've got a small food plot of clover or something, low growing clover, or wheat or something that we're going to let go fallow in the summer that serves as brood habitat, serves as for bugging opportunities, whatever. And if these critters get caught out in the open, they've got immediate escape cover into pollinator mixes that they can move around freely on the ground through, and they can even escape more into shrub motts or edge feathered or hedgerows around the edges. I mean, you're talking about a recipe for success. I mean, if we could all get on board doing something like that, that's the keys to the castle right there.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and then you even get to talking about, you know, little turkey poults and quail chicks, you know, trying to thermoregulate, and we have big swings in temperature. You know, it could be hot, it could be cold, it could be whatever. And you know, having that shrubs, man, they can go in there. I can't remember what the temperature readings were, but it was quite a bit of difference temperature wise getting under the shade as a poult, you know, in this shrub mott than it was out in the sun. And you know, a lot of people, we think about cold and damp and wet a lot when we're thinking habitat with, you know, turkey poults and quail chicks. We're talking about, you know, golf ball size, softball size, little critters, and especially when they're young. And we're very cognizant of moisture, dew of a morning, cool, that they're having trouble at least for the first 2 weeks thermoregulating. They're gathering under mama's wings, kind of a deal, huddling up, and then they walk through whatever, fescue, this, that, and the other, whatever, and they get wet, and they get hypothermia and they die. So we sometimes we really nail down on that a lot. But the flip side is we don't realize, and it's also 95 degrees, because it'll get like this on us pretty quick here. We're cold right now, but we won't be very long. It'll be 95 degrees and high humidity, and them little suckers are just panting their little tongues out of their head.
Yeah,
And
that's exactly right. And I'm sure everybody has been to Tractor Supply or somewhere around Easter time, and they see all these little chickens
yeah.
and little turkeys, poults that they've got inside Tractor Supply. Now you're talking about a building, inside a building under a roof that's climate controlled, and it's 70 degrees in there, but they still have heat lamps on them.
Yeah.
Every tub full of chicks will have heat lamps on them. Well, we can't do the heat lamp thing with wild critters. But if they didn't do that at Tractor Supply, the mortality rate on these things is going to be through the roof if they don't have heat lamps on them. So we got to do the next best thing we can do. But like, you and I were talking earlier today about dog kennels, and we were talking about, setting it up so that the dogs are comfortable without a lot of expense and a lot of maintenance. And that dogs need that thermal cover too. And one of the things we talked about, we were talking about heat for the dogs, but like you touched on just a minute ago, we're only going to have a few weeks out of the year here in the South that it's going to get extremely cold. So we're not necessarily always wearing a thermal cover. We're not talking about just protecting them from the cold, but some of these 90 and 100 degree days for weeks on end, we've got to have that thermal protection too. They've got to have some shade and some breeze. And so, a lot of people, I know I got in a heated discussion with a gentleman last night over what poults and chicks need, and he was talking about the predator issue. Well, there's way more to that. We've got to protect this brood once they're born from the elements, and plus give them what they need to survive and thrive, as well as being able to escape predation. Because everything out there wants to eat a turkey, including me. So.
I mean, at the end of the day, here's what I'm kind of trying to do. I don't know that I'll be able to rewind the clock 200, 300 years
Right.
on what my landscape looks like.
And you're probably not going to bring back buffalo and prairie chickens, even though that would be pretty cool, but probably not going
Well, I could introduce Buffalo. A
to
guy down the road, a guy down the road from me raised them.
happen. Okay.
And yeah, somebody said one of them got out one time, boy, and it was a sure enough deal. But anyhow, and then the rednecks tried to shoot them off the highway, and you just all kinds of craziness. But I would love to be able to take it all the way back to kind of what the good Lord really intended it for it to be like. I don't know that I'll ever get that far. But what I can do is rewind the clock, put it back historically as best I can. And the thing that makes that beneficial is it is good for your quail, good for your turkey, good for your deer. And what I mean by beneficial is, nutrition. We talk about this in deer, genetics, nutrition, and age. Well, it's really not a whole lot different in quail and turkey. If you can't get nutrition and age on them, you're not going to have a huntable population. So, what are we missing in that aspect? I had a buddy of mine today, I was visiting with, and there's a big turkey, primarily a big farm in Alabama that they hunt, and these six guys hunt that place pretty hard, and you know, usually they kill about 24 birds a year on that farm, and this past year they killed four. So I mean, people are like, I don't know what's going on, but something's going on. And I'm sitting here telling him, man, I don't have a turkey problem. I got turkey. And he's like, Thomas, this is crazy. I drove him across the farm today. He's like, this is crazy. He said, I ain't no wonder you got turkeys coming out your ears. He said, what about poachers? That was his next question. I said, now I got poachers.
We got poachers.
Yeah. But
you know, we've got a lot of people out there listening right now that are wanting bigger food plots. They're wanting to clear ground to have a bigger food plot. So these 4 and 5 acre openings that you've got, what have they been up until now?
Yeah, you know, so I don't want to get off on this rabbit hole, but so I like food plots because let's just think of it like this. I like food plots for the same reason I like deer camp. It's because culturally, at some point that got put in you that was the deal. I mean, you saw it on TV. These guys are hunting out of, you know, $2,000 to $5,000 shooting houses, deer stands, box stands, whatever term you want to use, elevated shooting house, whatever you call them. And they're hunting out of these really nice deer stands, and they're overlooking this food plot, and there's 6-8 deer feeding over here, and this big buck slipping out on the other side of the field going to check all the does, and pow, they, you know, they shoot him. And man, that is just awesome. I mean, how, and then that kind of turned into a deal where people even took it further and started, you know, they took a little bit of the science and blended it and started making, you know, they modified it to what they wanted. They started maybe they softened or feathered an edge in a switchgrass monoculture or something, you know, or they did God only knows what. And then they start doing what I call landscaping, you know, food plot landscaping. And man, that just really turns in. I mean, it goes from golf course manicured, curvy deals, lanes, and this and that and all this. And this is in clover, and this is in corn, and this is in some kind of crazy non-native that is probably going to be a problem, miscanthus or something, you know, who knows what. And I'm just like, man, we have really goofed it up on that deal. So what I'm trying to do is put it back like it was originally designed to be. And look, I've got some areas that I'm sure were not food plots that are now historically. So I'm not solely committed to like this purest form of native habitat, but I'm also not dumb enough to like go crazy in what I call the landscaping people, you know?
Well, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. But most of these areas have been food plots up until now, 4 to 5 acre food plots up until now. Why not keep them as 4 or 5 acre food plots?
All right.
Isn't bigger food plots always better?
No. So I've heard that before. Because I asked a guy one time something about what's the perfect size food plot and this and that and the other. And he said, man, he said, bigger's better. And he said, I would make it bigger. And I sat today with my son and a friend on a 5-acre food plot, okay, that is shaped kind of like a D, the letter D as in dog. All right. So, and the center of the field is kind of high and you know, crest in the center kind of slopes off each side. And the back end of the D, there's a road. So I planted that whole field for a couple years and the deer would use it, but man, it just wasn't
doing what I thought it ought to do. You know, it wasn't as consistent. It wasn't as, and you could be riding back there and you'd see a deer out there a quarter mile away and he'd see you or she'd see you and they'd be gone. And a couple years ago, I was getting ready to, you know, put that food plot in. And I drove up there with the spray rig and started spraying different areas. And when I drove up there, I looked, and in the front half of that, back towards the road where your straight line of your D is, there was a bunch of purple top that had just come on strong in the past couple weeks. You know, it was late summer. And I saw that purple top and I said, man, this stuff is waist chest high. This is chest high in here.
Now, you're not talking about purple top turnips.
No. Oh, the native warm season grass. So I looked at that and I thought, well, dang it. I probably shouldn't kill all this stuff. You know, what am I doing here? So I sprayed half of that field. I reduced that plot by half. And I left all that purple top out there. And then I planted the lower end of the U, the you know, of the food plot, which is where the deer stand is anyway. And I can drive up there now and deer can be standing out there, and as long as I don't stop or do something stupid, they'll stand there and watch me drive by like I ain't even there.
Yep.
And the reason is they feel more secluded.
Yep.
And they feel more hidden. They feel safer. And even this past year, you and I, we actually had to fire. I wasn't going to burn that, but the fire got over on it and whatever. Don't matter. And it burned it, which it came right back. It's all, you know, it's not like it damaged anything. I was just going to leave it to get a little thicker. But, you know, after that is burned, man, there lays a shed in that tall grass. I mean, so I know from what I've seen with, you know, bedding and use of the food plot and the relaxed state of the deer when they walk out there, I know that I have improved that food plot by shrinking it. And buffering really a much softer, more secluded edge. And I'm not done with all of it yet, but I said all that to say that bigger's not always better. And if you, you know, again, what's the purpose of your food plot? If you are really trying to push nutrition, you have some type of deficiency, a hole, and you're so focused on pushing nutrition that, you know, maybe you can, maybe you can't, whatever you want to say, you're going to do all this food plot. That's not how I view my food plots. Now, there are exceptions to that. Like when we had the Snowmageddon or whatever, and we got hammered, man. My deer on a daily basis were clearing out an area about the size of the hood of your truck of snow, pawing that out to get to my oats.
Yep.
And the oats were fine under there because it's almost like building the igloo type deal. And so they were hammering those things because they knew they had to. So in a period like that, a stress period, yeah, I'm absolutely providing supplemental nutrition to them, however you want to cut it, even if it's only for a week or 5 days, 3 days, whatever. Yes, I am doing something. And am I over the course of 12 months, January to December, am I changing things nutritionally, not just on my property, but for the herd that is coming and going? You know, I don't know that I'm really moving the needle there on a food plot. Now I am on my habitat. I'm confident of that. But am I on my food plot? I don't know. So the way I look at a food plot is this for me. Yes, it can provide some good nutrition. Yes, it can provide supplemental nutrition, especially in stress periods. But what it really does for me and this is the what this is the golden ticket. This is number one priority for me on a food plot, and that is it is a kill plot. And I want deer to stand out there where my kids can say, okay, that's an immature doe. That's a button buck. That's a mature doe. We're shooting her.
Yep. Even a place for turkeys to strip.
Oh, man, yes. I mean, and we shoot turkeys in these plots. I mean, or watch them, you know, coming and going and doing things. I mean, it is. Yeah, it's I think they're useful, but again, you can tweak them and make them better for sure by, you know, either the edge feathering you got going on, shrub plantings of different kinds to help form thickets and funnels and travel corridors and escape cover and thermal cover and all these different things. And in one area, we recently just chainsawed cedar trees down, and it has obstructed the view from the woods. Now I've edge feathered too, but not to the degree I want to, but that's all coming. But just dropping them cedars, doing cut and drop, has obstructed the view into the food plot exponentially.
Yeah.
So you know, there's just a lot of things like that you can do and tweak. And, you know, one thing you talked about earlier was TSI work. So, you know, seems like I've been in a constant TSI project for 5 years. And for whatever reason, there's been chatter on Facebook or wherever you saw it. I haven't seen it. But people not realizing they can hack and squirt this time of year.
Oh, absolutely. Dormant season, hack and squirt is one of the best times to do it.
For me, it is the time to do it. And I'll tell you why. No ticks, no chiggers.
No snakes.
No sweating. Now, the downside to that is you better be better at identifying what you're going to eliminate or kill.
Yep.
If you don't know your tree species, now, if you're just taking out a certain size and everything from this size down, no matter if it's an elm or a white oak, then that's different. Then you just got to know what a measuring tape is, basically. And if it's this size or less, you kill it.
Yep.
Or maybe if you've, whatever. But other than that, the only hiccup to this time of year TSI work is you don't have a leaf to look at and say, oh, this is a whatever.
Yeah, now, that's right.
I have seen guys look at leaves that are on the ground and look at the bark and really try and analyze, but that's probably not the best. So
that's right. And in these bottoms, you know, we get moss growing a lot of times on the trunks of some of these trees to the point that, you know, you almost have to look at some leaves to determine, but it's trees that we're really not concerned about. You know, is this a bitter pecan or is it a, cedar elm? Is it a is it an ash or is it something else? And you know, that's occasionally, you know, I'll look, people ask me, well, what kind of tree is this right here, and I'll have to look at the leaves. But most of the time when we're doing hack and squirt, that really doesn't matter because we're taking out sweet gums and we're taking out ash and we're taking out elms and we're taking out bitter pecan and hackberry and, you know, whatever else might be there. And, you know, the whole purpose of this is to get rid of, you know, we got to take some hostages, shoot some hostages so we can put some sunlight on the ground. And, you know, we're trying to increase early successional habitat and increase acorn production. So, you know, and we're even hacking, squirting some oak trees. You know, we hacking, squirted some great big overcups you couldn't even start to reach around. And, you know, a lot of people would frown about that and a lot of people cringed when we talked about taking out some of those big overcups, but, you know, sometimes it's necessary. And for us to regenerate red oaks, it was.
Yeah. Yeah. We have killed some oak trees specifically like a northern red oak that's on a south facing slope or something, you know, something that should not be there. But yeah, we've had to kill a few, and I'm gonna tell you, it hurts your feelings when you're looking at a nice red oak tree and you're killing that thing. Think, what in the world am I doing this for? But you know, at the end of the day, it meets your goals and your objectives, and it falls into place.
That's right. That's right. You talked about not have, you mentioned a while ago, you didn't have all of your does shot. I don't have all mine shot either. And I'm a little bit excited about that this year. I'm really wanting to shoot some late season does. And I'll tell you why. And it happens this way every single year. And I've even saw it. I know what they're talking about. But people, when they say the rut's going to be late this year,
yeah,
we hear that quite often. And we saw it this year, you know, and you shared a deal with me earlier. I've seen it before. But Arkansas Game and Fish puts out that thousands, this is based off of thousands and thousands of deer killed, and measuring fetuses out of them to see exactly when that deer was bred. And, you know, that's what we're determining peak of the rut by. And there's a set date that for throughout history, pretty much, that is when these getting bred.
And yeah, they've got, if I don't mean to say zones, but they've sectioned the state off in about four different groups.
Right.
And in each of those groups, they give a timeline that's usually about 2 week period, maybe. Is that right?
Well, for us here, where we're at, is November 22nd to December 1st.
Okay. Okay. And so, yeah, there's a week. There's at least a week variance there, I'd say. Yeah.
Well, and that lines up. You know, I have a fetus scale, and you know, we've shot a lot of does here over the last 10 years. In the late season, January, February, shot does, and we've removed fetuses and measured them. And, you know, this thing is pretty accurate. It's supposed to be accurate within like 24 hours of when she actually conceived.
Right.
So everything that we've had, and I've said it even before we looked at this deal again, and this deal came out this year, it's always that week of Thanksgiving up until about the 1st of December.
Yep.
And you know, that's always traditionally when it's been. Now, this year, things have been a little bit strange. And I hear a lot of people talking about, you know, we're at Christmas. And people are saying now, well, the rut was late. They're just now in the lockdown phase. And, you know, here it's Christmas time next week. So, I have purposely, well, not purposely, I was lazy and I didn't do what I was supposed to and I didn't shoot my does early. But now I'm purposely holding back about six or seven doe tags so that we can shoot some does in January and February and measure fetuses to see when she was conceived and be able to debunk or whatever this myth that it was late. Now, I know what they're talking about. We've, you know, it's week before Christmas now that we're recording this, and I saw bucks chasing does 3 days ago. We've got fresh scrapes on the ground. I've jumped bucks and does bedded together. We've still got a lot of does that still have fawns with them, and we've got does that are grouped up. We've got, I've got eight coming into my yard every night. That's just does and little ones. And, I don't know that those does have been bred yet. I still think there's some activity maybe going on, but I'm anxious to see when we remove some fetuses and are able to measure them, when some of these deer were actually bred.
Oh, yeah, it'll be interesting. Now, the data that Game and Fish has was taken over, golly, several years with thousands and thousands of deer. So what they're doing, you know, is measuring those fetuses, recording the date, all those data points and all those years, and they're kind of getting an average. So, yes. You know, there can be some swings either way, but in general, you know, I still say your rut's about the same time every year, you know, depending on your DNA.
I think so too. And, you know, even in those swings, there's going to be outliers. You know, there's going to be some does that get bred early, and there's going to be some that get bred late. So, you know, just taking a sample of one or two, I don't think is going to do it. But, you know, if we could get 5, 6, 8, 10 does and measure fetuses of them, I think that's going to kind of tell the tale. And I really think, even though there's some activity going on, I really think maybe the rut happened when it was pretty much supposed to happen. The peak was about the same time as normal. And I think maybe due to a bumper acorn crop this year, due to better habitat in the woods, due to better crops growing around us, maybe we had some of these doe fawns that have put on some weight quick enough that now they're big enough to be bred. What's your thoughts on that?
Oh, it's real possible. I can't remember. I've heard different numbers on that. 60, 80 pound, you know, fawn can carry a baby.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to go back, because we have killed two or three fawns off of some DMAP clubs accidentally. And it's going to be interesting to see what some of those weights look like this year compared to years past. Maybe the rut happened when it happened, and this scraping and this chasing activity that we're seeing late, you know, maybe it's time for some doe fawns. Maybe it happened a little quicker this year than what we normally see. Maybe we're seeing some of that activity taking place. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, man, it's possible. Sometimes, you know, we see things data-wise or science-wise, and then we see something in the woods, and in our minds somehow it doesn't connect. You know, what we see and what we have on paper and what we see in reality, sometimes two and two don't make four in our minds. But I do think, generally speaking, you got to be real careful. You know, I'm on a slippery slope, but generally speaking, if you can do a little more research, it most likely aligns with what is already established.
Now, if I agree 100%. Now, if we shoot 6 or 8 does here late season and it shows that they were bred at Christmas time, we're going to have a deer researcher with a PhD in his name on here to help us explain some of that. What's going on here?
Yeah. And you know what, if that's the case, they're going to have, which irritates me, but I understand, they're going to have an it depends scenario of possibles and probables of why that happened. You know,
but that's with everything. I asked my wife what's for supper tonight. She's going to say it depends.
Yeah.
Right. It depends on what I'm cooking
or how you act
or how I act. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
She definitely knows how to control me.
I promise, like a well-trained dog.
Oh yeah, I come in the other night and ask her. She was actually at the stove cooking something, so that's one of the times it's okay to ask, "What are we having for supper?" And boy, she named off what we was having, and I said, "Oh, honey, I love it when you talk dirty."
Yeah. Oh man.
Well, you got anything else?
Man, no, I don't. I guess our next episode will air after Christmas. So, you know, I hope everybody has a Merry Christmas and has time with their family and has fun, you know, opening presents and doing all the things you do, and hopefully get some time to think about Jesus and you know, spend some time with your family and thinking about that. I mean, I encourage you to whip out the old Bible, blow the dust off the cover and read, you know, read the story to your kids. You know, it'd take you 3 to 5 minutes, and it's time well spent, I think. But, you know,
Absolutely. You know, we get so busy and we get so caught up with things, and you know, life's pretty hectic, and it's really easy to forget what Christmas is all about, why we celebrate it and why we have it. And you know, it's, we have to, I myself have to make an intentional effort to really think about that every year, or you just get caught up in the grind.
Oh, so, yeah, I guarantee you do, man. It's, there ain't no doubt. Ain't no doubt about it.
I have to say, boy, my Christmas shopping was very easy this year. No one gave me a list, so I got everything that was on the list. So
I'm going to go shop maybe tomorrow, maybe.
Well, that's how it works around here. They're going to learn, you want something from me for Christmas, I better have a list, because I ain't just buying you some junk. You need to get something that you want. And I didn't get no list, so I was done, and mine was easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me know how that goes for you and if you're still sleeping in the house after Christmas.
Well, yeah. I took pretty good care of my wife.
Okay.
That's one thing I can say. But, yeah. But anyway, well, we hope y'all have a great Christmas, and we will catch y'all shortly after, and maybe we talk about an end of the year wrap up. Thank y'all for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.